Hey, football fans, it's Andrew Filippone, host of the First and Pod podcast. Join me and my co-host, three-time All-Pro Patrick Peterson, as we break down every game every week. New episodes drop on Monday and Friday mornings. Be sure to subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Odyssey, I'm Lauren Berry, and this is the On Deadline podcast, where we unpack the headlines you've heard from our radio newsrooms across the country. On Deadline today is the death of Jimmy Carter, a one-term president who left the Oval Office in defeat and then became a statesman and powerful force for human rights across the globe. In 1976, Jimmy Carter, then a peanut farmer, church leader, businessman, and state senator from Georgia, was elected to be president of the United States. The Harvard Law Review noted that with the memory of Watergate and Richard Nixon fresh in the public's mind, Carter won by calling for honesty and integrity in the government. But 4 years later, Carter lost his re-election bid to Ronald Reagan in a country that was beset by recession, inflation, and soaring gas prices, after hostages were taken by Iran and Carter's push to force automakers to lower emissions was met with hostility from the American business sector. In his short time in office, Carter had passed a national energy policy, deregulated transportation industries and banking, negotiated a historic peace agreement between Israel and Egypt, established diplomatic relations with China, concluded the SALT II Treaty, and gained ratification of the Panama Canal Treaty. When he was ushered out by voters, Carter didn't slink away into the private sector to build a billion-dollar empire. Instead, he and his wife Rosalind spent the last 40-plus years taking on human rights causes across the globe. With more on Carter's legacy is David Greenberg. He's a presidential historian and professor of history and media studies at Rutgers University, and he spoke with Odyssey in San Francisco.
Carter, who was in office from 1977 to 1981, became a favorite of many households because of his friendly personality, along with his underdog victory in the 1976 presidential race, when he defeated a host of higher-profile candidates, with Carter only serving one term as governor of Georgia before his presidency. So going back to that presidential race, how shocking was it to the political world that he won?
It really was a tremendous upset. You know, when Carter first told his mother that he was going to run for president, she said, "President of what?" The notion that this one-term governor of Georgia was a credible candidate was surprising to a lot of people. But he scored a big win in the Iowa caucuses, which were kind of emerging as a launching pad. And the media momentum that followed helped him to this surprise nomination and then a close one victory over Gerald Ford.
Looking back, how do we characterize his term? What made him appealing enough to win but not get reelected?
Well, Carter was, I think we have to say, a failed president. Simply did not have the skills or the experience, really, to succeed, especially at a very difficult time. We were facing inflation, unemployment, high interest rates. On the international front, the United States was kind of retreating from the world. We had the Iranian hostage crisis, which he failed to solve. And so I think just the combination of pressures overwhelmed this man who was, after all, a one-term governor from Georgia, had no Washington experience, no foreign policy experience, wasn't used to working with the United States Congress. And overall, he was overwhelmed in the job.
If we look back throughout history, a number of presidents have done all sorts of things behind the scenes, shenanigans, maybe not so nice at times. Jimmy Carter seems like he was and always has been a real nice guy.
Well, he was in some respects a nice guy. I'm sure he was and is and has his fans. But the people who worked closely with him did not always feel that way. He could be very pious and prickly, very moralistic in the way he condescended to others. And I think that, too, was part of the source of his troubles as president. He didn't find a way to sort of get on well with even Democratic Party leaders in Congress. And, you know, he almost invited a challenge from Ted Kennedy, sort of the leading liberal senator of the day. Carter repelled the challenge in 1980, but it was a sign of his weakness, a sign that he didn't have the support even of his own party.
And just briefly talk about post-presidential work, Habitat for Humanity, and other things like that.
Well, here again, Carter, I think there's a mixed bag, some very admirable work. Habitat for Humanity, he helped out with that group building homes for the needy. He worked with election monitoring overseas. But he was also known for meddling in the foreign policy of his successors. And both President Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton found that he went behind their back to do things that were against the American national interest. He got into trouble for anti-Semitic remark, calling Israel an apartheid state late in his life. So, you know, again, it's a mixed legacy.
The Carters, Jimmy and Rosalynn, were one of the first presidential power couples, a pair whose public and private lives were so intertwined you can't really talk about one without the other. Rosalynn Carter died November 19, 2023, in Georgia. She was 96 years old. Her husband had already been in hospice care for almost a year when she died, and he still made his way to the funeral of the woman who he'd been married to for 77 years. While Jimmy was president, he sent Rosalynn abroad as an official diplomat representing the United States. She attended cabinet meetings where she was never afraid to speak up, and privately they had nightly phone calls whenever they were separated by travel or other obligations. The Carters never danced with anyone except each other at White House functions. After leaving Washington, they co-founded the Carter Center, and they traveled the world together for human rights causes, meeting with world leaders and developing plans to fight diseases. They're even credited with nearly eradicating the deadly guinea worm parasite in the developing world. The Associated Press noted that there are remote villages within the 145-plus countries they visited between them where children, many now adults, are named Jimmy or Rosalynn or simply Carter. Rosalynn was praised for fighting the stigma of mental health issues, especially for women. She was so struck by the plight of women caring for mentally ill children and other relatives that when her husband ran for governor of Georgia, she went to one of his campaign rallies and waited in line to shake his hand. "I came to see what you are going to do to help people with mental illness when you are governor," she announced. He responded by creating a state commission to improve services for those with mental illness. Then, as president, he created a national commission on mental health. Jimmy Carter released a statement at Rosalynn's death. It said, "Rosalynn was my equal partner in everything I ever accomplished. She gave me wise guidance and encouragement when I needed it. As long as Rosalynn was in the world, I always knew somebody loved and supported me." Steve Roberts of ABC News talked to Odyssey in Buffalo, New York, about what else Rosalynn Carter will be remembered for.
Well, I think for two things. There was the public Rosalynn Carter, who during 4 years in the White House helped shape our modern view of a first lady. 16 years before Bill and Hillary Clinton famously said, "Buy one, get one free," that's what happened with the Carter administration. She was a full partner in the White House. She had her own role, her own office. She went to cabinet meetings. She testified on Capitol Hill. She pushed legislation on mental health and other areas. She traveled the world representing him. But she also, let's remember, the Carters were only in office for 4 years. They had then were, after the presidency, 43 years since they left the White House. And in many ways, the most lasting legacy, perhaps of both of them, I think, was the way they lived their faith every day, not just on Sundays, but every day. They didn't go out and, you know, buy a mansion or a yacht. They didn't lobby Congress. They didn't. What they went was back to their modest home in Plains, Georgia, and lived a life of community devotion and charity, you know, building houses for humanity and so many other ways. And in some ways, I think it's the modesty and grace of the Carters, and Mrs. Carter in particular, that's her lasting legacy.
Do you have a memorable story from covering her back when you were with the New York Times?
I do. I was covering her in the 70s. I was in the bureau, as you say. She came to lunch one day. And now, interestingly, this was not a social call, and it was not to talk about the White House drapes or the, you know, redecorating the White House. This was a policy lunch, and I was assigned to write a news story about her, what she said at the lunch. But then afterwards, I went home that night and said to my wife, Cokie, "You'll never guess what Mrs. Carter did today." And she said, "Of course, Stephen, I know exactly what she did. She went into the kitchen and thanked the help after the lunch." And I said, "How did you know that?" She said, "Because she's a well-bred Southern woman. Any of us would do that." And that was very much a part of her persona. But that was, so there was a softness and a grace and charm to her that Hillary Clinton never had. But she also, at the same time, was an extremely important advisor to him. And if you look at the obituaries, one of the things I noticed was saying, if you look at his speeches and the drafts of his speeches, repeatedly her handwriting shows up because she was his best editor. But I can also tell you that it was not a perfect marriage, even after 77 years, because everybody listening to us knows there's no such thing as a perfect marriage. And I know the guy who was their book editor when they once were writing a book together, and he said they almost killed each other, that he had to fly down from New York and broker a peace deal between the two of them that rivaled the Camp David Accords in its delicacy and diplomatic difficulty. So 77 years of marriage, the partnership, the longest marriage of any president in our history.
The Harvard Business Review talked to President Carter in 1998 and asked him this question: how do values shape leadership? He answered that high moral and ethical standards are essential, and they don't change from one job to another or from one level of authority to another. Carter said honesty, truthfulness, integrity, unselfishness, these are always there. And whenever a leader violates these basic principles through arrogance or through ignorance, there's a degradation of duty. He added that leaders also have a duty to understand the needs of people who depend on them. I've never been a victim of racial discrimination, Carter said. I've never been deprived of basic human rights. I've never suffered from hunger or lack of shelter. As a businessman, as a church leader, and a political leader, I became intensely aware of the needs of others in the Deep South during segregation, although I wasn't always as courageous as I should have been in trying to alleviate those problems. But understanding the needs and suffering of others is a vital element for successful leadership. Blanca Howard from Odyssey in Dallas discussed the down-to-earth Carters she spent time with when they came to town for Habitat for Humanity.
So here, when we hosted the project in 2014, Dallas and Fort Worth Habitat affiliates combined actually built 50 new homes as part of the Carter Work Project, 50 homes in 1 week. So you can imagine the energy, the momentum around that. And then in addition to that, we repaired dozens of homes for existing homeowners in the same communities that we were building in. On the Dallas side of things, we actually focused our effort in the East Oak Cliff community. So right over behind the VA hospital in Dallas, and our affiliate built 30 new homes as part of that project, all on a couple of streets. So you can just imagine what it was like to be out there with literally hundreds of volunteers who come from all over the country to support President and Mrs. Carter, their entire family who shows up as part of this project as well, and, you know, elected officials, volunteers, and of course, most importantly, the new homeowners, the Habitat homeowners that build right alongside.
President Carter was 90 at the time that he came to North Texas. Did he delegate, or how much work did he do?
There is no such thing. I don't know that delegation exists in President Carter's vocabulary. He's a can-do kind of a person. He's extremely hands-on. He had turned 90 just literally 2 weeks before our project. And I actually had the tremendous fortune of being selected to work on the house that President Carter was building on. So right literally alongside him. And as a staffer, my responsibility was to ensure that under no circumstances whatsoever, President Carter got on a ladder or got on a roof. And they said, Blaine, if there is a task to be done that requires getting on a ladder or getting on the roof, he will do it. And no one, including you, can tell him no. So your job is to make sure everything that needs to be done is ground level. And so what we actually did, which was a ton of fun for our new homeowner, is we always build porches on the front of our Habitat homes. So hers was no different. But we actually, for the Carter House, had President Carter build a beautiful railing all along the outside of the porch. And that ensured he had plenty of work to be done at ground level. So that kept his staff happy, President Carter safe, and the homeowner happy.
I was going to say, you just said his family was there. So, I mean, that's going to be even tougher. I would be looking at, like, you know, the family, like, you're going to help me out here?
Absolutely not. They were like, no, he's his own man. He does his own thing. So, I mean, he was out there using a miter saw. He was swinging a hammer. He was doing all the things. And I mean, I have never met, truthfully, in all of my time at Habitat, I've had the fortune of working for this organization now going on 12 years. I have come across so many volunteers, and I would be hard pressed to think of somebody who's not only as hardworking and dedicated as President Carter, but most importantly, as compassionate and really attuned to the families that are being supported as part of Habitat's mission. So every morning before we started construction, he would gather the group of volunteers who was going to be building on that home that day, and he would lead the volunteers in prayer, make sure we say a special prayer for the homeowner that we were building this house for. He got to know her on a personal level and asked her questions. And I will share, our homeowner who was on President Carter's house actually only really spoke Spanish. She was primarily Spanish speaking. And President Carter is not fluent in Spanish, but he is a former president. So he knows enough to be dangerous. And he definitely exercised his Spanish-speaking skills that day, made sure he offered a few words in Spanish to our homeowner, which really meant a lot to her.
What did it mean for not only the office staff, but the volunteers to have the former president there with you? That had to be some kind of inspiration for them.
Oh, it was incredibly inspirational. It was also just so such an out-of-body experience, right? Here our volunteers are in a neighborhood doing what they do every single Saturday, right? They're so dedicated coming down every Saturday and helping to swing a hammer on a Habitat home in this neighborhood for many, many years. It just so happens that this week they're doing it alongside a former president. I mean, it was pretty phenomenal. And just, you know, being on that house allowed me the opportunity to see people kind of streaming by, you know, that were building on one of the other 29 homes going on, and they'd walk by, and you know, everyone's like a little shell shocked, like, oh, you know, can I get a picture? Can I see him? Is he out there? Can I talk to him? Okay. So people were really excited. Even, you know, existing residents who weren't necessarily part of the project, but you know, we had to let them know, of course, hey, there's going to be, you know, major security detail out here, wow, the Secret Service, you know, out in full force, obviously. So it was a really neat experience. But I'll also share regarding volunteers, to your question, like I mentioned, Carter Work Project goes on an annual basis. And actually, many of our volunteers here at Dallas Habitat have supported the Carter Work Project as ambassadors for our affiliate in other Carter Work Projects across the world, including the Dominican Republic, Nepal, and other areas. So it's been really neat to be able to take that tradition and carry it on at other affiliates across the globe.
Do you have any stories? Did you have some conversations with him that stuck to your head?
I do. I have a story that I often tell, and it's just a funny story to reminisce on. The Carter Work Project, when we hosted it at Dallas, was in October. So we know here in Dallas that normally October is, you know, very pleasant weather. Not October 2014, though. It was very, very hot. It was actually over 100 degrees when he was out on site. So you can imagine there were some safety concerns about staying hydrated and that sort of thing. And so one of the days it ended up getting very hot. And one of our staff members said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to run and get some ice pops for everybody. We just want to make sure that people, you know, stay hydrated and all the things. So she ran and got some ice pops. And I really had try to be respectful and not, you know, overstep my boundaries with the president working on his house that week. So we hadn't exchanged too many words, but I did have the opportunity to ask him, and Mr. President, would you like an ice pop? And he told me, yes, please. I think I'll take lime. And that was our exchange. That was our exchange, was over an ice pop. So that's my, you know, my claim to fame with President Carter.
I love that. You know, the years now have passed. How has something so monumental like that continued to build the rapport and also the success of Habitat for Humanity as we now move into almost 10 years past?
The legacy that President Carter and Mrs. Carter have left on Habitat families across the globe and on those of us who work for Habitat affiliates is incredible. I don't even have words to be able to describe the tremendous impact and legacy. He is the most well-known volunteer, but not just volunteer, true advocate and champion for this mission. He has brought along so many other supporters who may not have otherwise engaged and Habitat's mission and come alongside our work. And most importantly, I think what really drives this is how he has impacted every single family who has benefited from these projects. And so when I think about the 30 families who benefited as part of the Carter Work Project here in Dallas, I think about how over the last 10 years, they have built generational wealth. They have sent kids to college. They have started businesses. They have enjoyed economic mobility. They have reaped the benefits of home ownership, and that is in large part due to him. That is his legacy, and we can't thank him enough for that.
In these turbulent times, we here at On Deadline will leave you with Jimmy Carter's thoughts on power and how it should be wielded. Our country is certainly the most powerful nation on earth, Carter said in a 1988 interview. Economically, militarily, politically, sometimes even morally and ethically. But that doesn't mean, quote, we can use this tremendous power to subjugate other people or to impose our will on others against their wishes, or to intrude into the internal affairs of another country unless our own security is directly threatened. We should use our influence not to create or sustain conflict and animosity and suffering throughout the world, but to alleviate it, Carter said. And although we have the most powerful military force on Earth, we should use that force with great reticence. Whenever possible, we should use diplomacy and negotiation to alleviate friction, to bring disputing parties together, to resolve matters through peaceful means. This show is produced by Joe Heady, Christy Strauser, Myron Kaplan, and Bill Smee. I'm Lauren Berry, and I want to say thanks for listening to On Deadline, Odyssey's serving of a top news story just for you. Subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts to stay informed.